you can host the best backyard barbecue. When you find a professional on Angie to make your backyard the best around. Connect with skilled professionals to get all your home projects done well. Inside to outside, repairs to renovations. Get started on the Angie app or visit Angie.com today. You can do this when you Angie that.
Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Hi there. Welcome to The Good Place, the podcast.
Janet, what's a podcast?
A podcast is a thing humans invented to procrastinate from doing important things, like actual work or spending time with their families.
Neat. Enjoy this week's episode.
Welcome to The Good Place, the podcast. I'm Mark Evan Jackson. I play Sean. Today we're talking about Chapter 24, Season 2, Episode 10, Rhonda, Diana, Jake, and Trent. Directed by Alan Yang, written by Jen Statsky and Dan Schofield. Including guest cast, Dax Shepard, Jamie Williamson, Jason Mantzoukas, Mary Beth Monroe, Ross Bryant, Dao Mora, Jim Meskimen, Fran Gillespie, and Behzad Dabu. Jason, Chidi, Tahani, and Eleanor hide in the Museum of Human Misery's Hall of Low-Grade Human Crappiness in the Bad Place. They wind up at a Bad Place party and assume their own demon personas to blend in. Their cover is blown once it's revealed that the party is for an exhibit for the human's own torture experiment, and Jason uses his Molotov cocktail skills to get them out. Meanwhile, Michael navigates his old office in search of travel pins necessary for the group to get to the judge. He ends up in Sean's situation room for an illegal raid of the medium place in an attempt to recover the four humans. Michael steals the travel pins and runs away from Sean and his minions. When they realize they are one travel pin short, Michael tells Eleanor he's finally figured out the solution to the trolley problem and pushes her through the portal, sacrificing himself. My guests today are set decorator Kim Wanup and director of photography David Miller. David and Kim, welcome. Everything is great.
It is. Thank you so much for inviting us in today.
Yes, thank you for having us.
Oh, thanks for doing it. First things first, we should mention that we are recording this episode on the Paramount lot in a post-production house where apparently they are editing, I don't know, Transformers a billion? You can hear what I'm hearing, right?
They're transforming. Yeah.
And you should have made your little plug because you have been in multiple Michael Bay movies yourself.
For a total of about 9 seconds.
It doesn't matter.
It counts.
Oh, count it. In any case, beloved listener, if you do hear a car crash or a large machine turning into a larger machine or gunfights or an orchestral score, that's the sound of my thoughts. Let's get started with what it is that both of you do. It's fascinating and very specific. I said cinematographer earlier, David, and you said director of photography. Are those different one from another?
No, I think, you know, it's a descriptive phrase, but I mean, I think director of photography sums it up a bit better because I'm the one kind of figuring out how it gets laid out, how it gets staged, how it gets lit, you know, working with the director, you know, with the producers trying to figure it out. So, I mean, it's a more all-encompassing view, I think, than just being a cinematographer.
And how does
But I wouldn't be insulted if you...
It's not a...
It's not insulting.
Camera dude would be less...
I would never hear that type of phrase come out of your mouth anyway,
good.
So I would never expect that of you.
But how does one become that? What's the job ladder? Did you go to school for this?
Yeah, I went to pharmacy school.
Is that true?
And I came up in the 80s, and so knowing how to
dose
people...
Are you being
people,
at all serious?
I'm totally serious.
You went to pharmacy?
I did.
You
I
went to pharmacy school.
Through, you know, all through high school, I worked at the local pharmacy, Vincent's Pharmacy in Rockville, Connecticut.
Amazing.
And... you know, I started pharmacy school and that was going to be my future, but it wasn't really what I was interested in. I was really interested in filmmaking and I was lucky enough to have parents who realized at a certain point, this is really stupid. So we should go ahead and let him do what he wants to do. And so I went to film school. You know, I moved to New York. I got into the union. I became an assistant cameraman. I worked on a lot of movies and TVs, and it was in the 80s, and commercials were really successful at that time. And sure. they were, you know, huge budgets.
And shot on film.
Right? Yeah. And money was no object. I mean, you know, I remember doing a commercial with Lauren Hutton riding an elephant through the jungle, and we built the entire jungle in Astoria stages, you know, and just, it just didn't matter.
Money to burn. Wow.
You know, it was before the crash.
Yeah.
And, but it was a tremendous learning experience. And I ended up working for a lot of, I was really fascinated with British film. And I ended up working for a lot of British cameramen. And what would happen is once my name got around, if somebody was coming in from the UK, they'd be like, oh, hire David. He, you know, can handle working with
British.
Us. He speaks American, you know, British. But, you know, you can understand him.
Yeah.
And so that was it. You know, I worked for a lot of people. And then I just started shooting. And I shot loads of commercials. I directed a lot of commercials.
Okay.
But I realized at a certain point, it really wasn't what I... You know, I liked the financial ramifications of directing commercials,
yeah.
but the enjoyment of it became, you know, bite the burger. Okay, bite, smile, and spit.
Right.
Bite, smile, spit.
It's high stakes because there are giant corporate dollars behind
right.
it, so there are a lot of masters, right?
Yes.
There's the client, and there's
yeah.
the agency, and it's yeah. less fun.
It's work for hire.
Right.
Yeah.
When you say assistant cameraman... Are those, is that a title still in use today?
Yeah,
are those
absolutely.
The people that are pulling focus or
exactly.
doing media?
No, like, I started out putting film in magazines,
yeah.
you know, and putting tape on the floor.
When you say putting tape on the floor, you're putting colored
for
tape.
For marks people like you to stand on.
Yes, yes, yes. Because we're morons. Because
obviously if we let you walk around by yourselves, nothing would ever get made.
Not without a helmet.
So there's bright, shiny tape on the floor for you to stand on.
He's not kidding.
Yeah, no, I'm not kidding. And, you know, when I was lucky enough, I worked for this guy, Brian West. I was an assistant cameraman for him. And usually the pattern goes, you are an assistant cameraman, you become a camera operator, then you'd be hopefully move up from there. And he was just like, you should just move up.
Really?
Because he said, you know more about what's going on in the set than anybody else, half the crew, you know, and you know how to light already. And so he was great. And he was fantastic because the first movie he had worked on was, he was the assistant cameraman on The Third Man.
Oh, wow.
And, you know, was the camera operator on Guns of Navarone and Oliver. And so it was really, really good training, and I learned
wow.
a lot from him. But also he was the one who said, you know, he gave me the support to move up. And so I did, you know, and here I am.
Here you are. And you are not the first story on this podcast about someone who was headed down a different road.
Yeah.
It's happened several times. But David Niednagel, the VFX supervisor, for instance, has a degree in economics with a minor in Scandinavian studies.
Yes.
And has never been to school for compositing and visual effects.
You know, but if you need to go out to IKEA, he's the guy to take.
The dude.
Yeah.
Kim, what is a set decorator?
A set decorator is a person who decorates the set with furniture or rugs or lamps or
okay.
the drapery, the little smalls, puts the character into the room with furniture.
When you say smalls, I'm thinking of like a ball made of twigs.
A vase.
Yeah.
That perfectly represents that character.
So where does it fall? How do you interact with other departments? I think of like production designer or properties or that sort of thing.
The designer and I work very closely. I also work closely with props. But the designer would create the size of the room, the look of the room, and then I'm more of the details of it. So he would say, if it's this room and it's going to be brick and it's going to have that like New York feel, then we collaborate that way to dress it that way.
And where and how did you learn to do this?
I went to school for interior design in
cool.
Philadelphia and quickly learned that architecture and interior design is boring.
Oh, wow.
And you don't make a lot of money.
Okay.
So, and I've always had a passion for film and TV. So I moved out like 2 weeks after college and just worked my way up as a PA.
You moved to Hollywood 2 weeks after college.
Yeah.
Wow.
And then a set PA and then office PA and then art department. And I just stalked designers until they hired me. Like if I changed the font on my resume, I resent it to 20 people.
Sure.
I was just, I'm good at that.
Oh, you got to hustle, right?
Yeah, I'm a hustler.
That's another tale that we hear a lot on this podcast is about like putting in the hours kind of thing. Like you just got to do it and you got to take gigs that are,
right.
you know,
yeah.
not where you want to end up, but you're going to make relationships and make contacts with folks. And I feel like that's universal in probably every aspect of filmmaking.
I think so. I always thought it's not like who knows, it's not like who you know, it's more who can remember you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And who will think of you when they need a decorator or a director of photography. Like, you want to be memorable.
Positively. The another aspect that we've run into tons in talking about this wonderful program, The Good Place, is that it's an unusual television show. It's bigger than most half hours of American network
Absolutely.
Television. And yet, when I see directors and Mike and such coming to each of you and going, we have to do this really ambitious, completely impossible thing, you all seem to go, okay. Like,
yeah,
it's not a challenge against your ego. No one gets defensive. You all go, it'll take me just a minute, but I'll be right back. You know, like,
yeah.
And you all seem to go and do it.
Well, that's the job. I mean, I think, you know, to survive in this business, you have to be the problem solver, not the problem,
mm-hmm.
you know, and that's how you get ahead. If you're the person who can always figure it out or come up with something at a moment's notice, you will work.
Yeah.
You know,
Mike is also one of the nicest people in the world, and you just want to be a part of whatever he's got going on. So.
Kim, Mike asked me to ask you about the story that he thought your name was Janet forever.
Yeah. Well,
I don't think that's actually true, right?
I really did think it was true because I was on Parks and Rec for 4 years.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, as sweet as Mike is, you know, we see him all the time and everything. But I had noticed maybe after 2 seasons, he never really said my name.
Sure.
So as a joke with a couple of the other producers, mm-hmm. Morgan Sackett, David Hyman, Dean Holland.
Sure.
I said, I kind of think Mike doesn't know my name. And they said, well, let's just start calling you Janet and see if he picks it up or whatever.
Right.
And so the end of Parks, at the very end, it was one of our last meetings, and they all sort of called me Janet here and there because they knew it was like the last time we could maybe have this joke. And he said, you know, I don't really know why they're calling you Janet because I know your name.
Right.
And then I just felt so bad
right.
because it wasn't like we were playing a joke on him.
Sure.
And then I felt like, oh my
but
God,
betrayed
we're not.
One of the sweetest men in the world.
Yeah. Yes.
Okay, good.
I
all
was
right.
like,
yeah.
oh
well
no.
Done. Yeah.
So it kind of backfired, but now he always calls me Janet.
I love it.
And
oh.
deep down, I think Janet's named after me, so.
deep down, you should know that Janet is, like that Mike revealed today, that Janet's the name when he was like, oh, it's a woman's name. This is just a placeholder. I'll just write Janet for the moment. And that's how Janet became Darcy's character in this show years and years later. David, Mike asked me to talk to you about the conversations that you had when you were talking about coming to work for this show, because he said that in Parks and Rec and stuff, it'd be, you know, 2 or 3 cameras, run and gun, light it, rip it. Mike said he never wanted to never wanted that show, doesn't want to work on a show where actors only got a take or two because we were running out of time, because whatever. But that this show looks different and the cameras move differently and are lit differently. What were those conversations like?
Well, it was funny because what happened was I got called by my agent to do the pilot that Drew was going to direct.
Mm-hmm.
And I was shooting something else, so I turned it down.
Oh, wow.
And then a month or so later, maybe 2 months later, they called again. And I was shooting another show, and I really didn't want to go back. And David Hyman and I had worked together. We've known each other. We worked together on West Wing.
Oh.
So that's where we had met. And so I was, you know, the show was ending. I was like, do I really want to go back? And then David called and he's like, we really, why don't you just come in and have a meeting about this? So I went in and I met Drew, and then Mike was there and Morgan was there. David wasn't there. David Miner. Thanks a lot, David. And we just talked about it. And he just, you know, he said, you know, he didn't want to make Parks. And I was very honest. I said, I had no interest in making a show like Parks.
Okay.
I don't mean that to, as, you know,
aesthetically,
it's just not very interesting to me.
Interesting.
But if you are interested in trying to make something different, then, you know, I would be interested in doing it. And I think also, you know, Mike was trying to find somebody who could give him what he wanted. He wanted the 3-camera thing, which I've been doing for years, so it's pretty easy for me. And but he wanted somebody who had some kind of vision for it, because I think they were still unsure about what exactly it was supposed to be. And then we found out that he and I actually grew up within like 20 miles of each other.
Is that right?
In Connecticut. And so, and also, you know, it was just a perfect confluence of events, because David wanted to work with me again.
Uh-huh.
He had recommended me to Morgan. KB had said something to him because, you
That's
know.
That's code for Kristen Bell.
Kristen Bell. Because I had shot Parenthood with Dax. Oh, and so nice. I've known her, you know, since for a long time.
Yeah.
And so it was just a great thing. So we talked about, you know, what he wanted to do. And I, you know, and as we talked about it, you know, Drew had tried to do certain things in the pilot, which some of which he accomplished and some that didn't get accomplished because of just, you know, photographic reasons. But watching it and, like, listening to Mike, I had a pretty good idea before, you know, we walked on the set of how I was going to do it. And then, you know, we went ahead and did it, and that was it. You know, the template that got laid out from the first episode, the first beside the pilot, you know, just worked.
It's prettier. It's more elegant.
Yeah.
It's the motion of the cameras and the action is less fly on the wall documentary,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah. I mean, it shouldn't be that because, you know, The Good Place is The Good Place,
right.
Until we find out that it's not.
Wait, what?
But it should be, you know, I wanted it to be aspirational.
Interesting.
You know, that was, you know, one of the things that I said when we talked, because I had not seen the pilot, so I didn't really know what was going on, but I knew the concept and everything, you know, and I wanted in my head to be The Good Place, to be the place that we all wanted to go to.
Yeah.
And so how do I make that happen?
And obviously speed is the concern, right?
Oh, yeah.
Because you could do it given unlimited time, but you guys light really quickly.
Like, yeah.
Faster than most shows I work on.
Yeah.
They bring the actors in for rehearsal. We'll read the lines once. You might mark where we are with the colorful tape so that the morons don't get lost. And then we may read it one more time. Then you say, give me 15 minutes. And you and DDA and who else?
Yeah, and Lou, you know, and it's just, I mean, the thing is, I already know how it's going to go together before you come in.
Is that right?
Yeah. I mean, in my head, I know, you know, I've read it beforehand, you know, and I'll read the script when I get it, and then I'll read it in the morning before I come back in, you know, when I'm having coffee at home, mm-hmm. before I drive in. And so I've got a pretty good idea, you know, honestly, some directors have a good understanding of how the show will go together, some don't, you know. But it's also at this point, after the third or fourth episode, you know, you're working with a lot of actors who are very competent, mm-hmm. and extremely seasoned.
Oh, good heavens, yes.
Yes, like the one sitting next to me, to my left. And
that's not who I'm talking about.
Oh, it's good. Come on. And so they kind of know, you know, it's funny because like KB and Ted, you know, we'll see where I'm standing in the room. And mm. I think that's a big thing. Like Ted will see where I'm standing and he'll start to do something. And then he'll even say sometimes, he goes, oh, you're standing over there. And then he'll like turn to make the shot work.
Yeah.
You know, so they know.
He's seasoned.
Know.
Yeah.
Yeah. And same thing with, you know, with Kristen, they just, you know, after a while, you know, and it's so much of it's common sense, but so many times common sense eludes a lot of people.
I've taken your note and I will do my best moving forward.
I was just trying. That's why we always have you sit.
So. I love sitting. No notes. In this episode, we open on the train heading across a black expanse. Now, is the train, do you have anything to do in that? The train's sort of more fixed. It's not furniture, right?
No, it was established from first season also, so right. I didn't.
There wasn't much to it. It was, you know, it was the shell of the train.
Right.
You know, and they went in and they added blinds. Actually, I think the blinds were even there.
Yeah.
So it was pretty much off the shelf. You know, it was a little bit more, it was not in the best of condition. So I think it was more of cleaning it up a little bit.
Oh, interesting.
And
okay.
getting it shootable than anything else.
I feel like I 90% understand the cinematic, the camera term, the line. Right. In this one, you're sort of shooting down the aisle at people sitting on the left-hand side of the train. And then we see from outside, but it works. It,
yeah.
My brain says maybe we crossed a line, but I guess they're sitting, so does it matter?
Well, I think, you know, a lot of times, you know, it's not as hard and fast a rule. I think, listen, people are more, you know, their visual intellect today because of all the different things, because of the way movies are done, Michael Bay films, we're sitting in his building. Mm-hmm. You know, we can get away with a lot more. And so I think a lot of times, you know, geography just kind of tells you where you are.
Mm-hmm.
And so you're inside the train on one side, you're outside the train on the other. It all kind of works. Sometimes it's a jump.
Our brains can interpolate.
Yeah.
Okay.
You know, and sometimes it's done for creative reasons. Sometimes it's just like, oh, I can't put the camera on this side of the room because there's a gigantic wall there. You know, mechanics end up trumping, you know, all artistic vision in the end.
For sure. We are told about the IHOP, which is a little bit different in this episode than we know on back on Life on Earth. This is the interdimensional whole of pancakes, where you don't so much eat pancakes as they eat you. And it sets up a lot, that we establish some things that are, you know, really vital. It's one thing that I feel like this show does really well, planting seeds that later materialize. Yeah. In this case, the senior staff pins, the thumbs down pins that become a giant plot device later.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, the great thing about Mike is that he really does have a vision plotted out for what the show is going to be and where it's going down the line. You know, we're in, sometimes in the tone meeting, and we'll be talking about something, and then he'll say, well, this happens, and you can see the bewilderment, you know, on our faces.
In the rest of us.
Yeah, and then he'll go, okay, in five episodes down the road, this is going to happen, this is setting up this point, which will then appear or reappear again. So it's very, you know, he's very, very well thought out. It was so nice because, you know, working other shows, which, you know, sometimes the scripts come in chaos, and I went to the first read-through, the first episode I was doing, and they did it. He timed it himself, and he was like, oh, you know, it's 2.5 minutes over. I've got to cut 2 pages out.
Wow.
So that's, you know, how exacting he is. It's pretty impressive.
I spoke with him earlier today, as a matter of fact, and was talking about his ability to juggle all these really different brain pathways of, and also maintain a fairly encyclopedic knowledge of the show
and baseball. Yeah.
The really deep baseball cuts. Yeah. I love this episode because it's more period piece than other episodes. You know, they have these super bad place costumes they've got to fit in, and it's a really lovely aesthetic.
Sean's office,
we see.
Yes,
indeed. How do you frame the aesthetic? It's sort of, I think of it as like steampunk madman.
Yes, steampunk art deco.
Art deco's
great. That look. But I definitely think there's some steampunk in there. And it's something that they had established in season one.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And we just followed through with. But it's great to see that things go back to being analog.
Yes.
And not so high tech.
Right.
And that you could, maybe they could run this whole world on these like button machines.
It's fuses and tape and
Yeah. It's a great concept.
Where do you get that stuff?
Prop houses. There's the prop houses, one specifically, History for Hire, that has a bunch of like old of those adding machines or the old ledger books. And but it's probably takes like 4 or 5 prop houses to get the amount that we needed for that architect's office.
Now, are these giant warehouses that you go and tour? Is there a catalog online and you're like, I need 3 of these? Or
Some prop houses have things online, but you really need to see it.
You need to touch it.
Because there could be a giant scratch in it, or, you know, it could be, the size might be off online. And then I've done that many times where you get something
right?
And think it's like, oh, that's like, that should fit perfectly on the table. And you're like, oh, wait, it's a pocket calculator.
It's miniature.
Yeah.
So you have to touch it.
I think so, especially when it's character pieces. Sean's office, I mean, I did all of that. The architect's office, those rows and everything,
right.
That's like 10 calculators, 10, 20 ledgers. You know, I can send my assistants out to do that.
I was going to say, how big is your team?
I have a lead man, Patrick Alvin, and then I have a buyer for that season was Ethan Goodwin. So between Ethan and I, we would go out. And,
because one of you is on set generally, right?
Well, I'm only on set to open.
Okay.
And then if I get called to set, there's something wrong.
Oh, interesting. Interesting.
I'm never really on set.
David wants to see you right away.
Does that call get made? I mean,
I don't answer
show.
That call. So
no.
It doesn't. But I hand it off to the on-set dresser.
Okay.
He's sort of my voice on the set.
Who's that, Jordan?
Jordan, yes.
Okay, yeah.
And so he's like my sort of like the protector of the set, or like.
He's good at it.
Yeah. He's very
Between
good. He's artistic.
Jordan and Julie, like, things get back to where they should be. You know, they make sure that if a dumb actor's moved something, they're like, I know.
By the way, put that back.
Yeah. And they're great. Also, Jordan's trip, because it's like, oh, you know, I need a lamp for over there. He goes, oh, give me a minute.
Yeah.
Oh, you know, that wall spear, let's get a painting for that. We weren't going to see this, but now we're going to see it.
Right.
So can you make it into something? And he's really good at whipping it into something in a very, very quick time.
He's quick and artistic. And
yeah.
he knows he can really frame, frame out the.
Yeah, he's very clever.
That makes me think. We also learned, speaking with others on this podcast, that in the various reboots, some of the same elements would just be moved around, like within Michael's office, right? Like
Michael's.
Just, and even Eleanor's house?
Eleanor's,
yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Michael's, I think we changed out some paintings.
Mm-hmm.
And I would just keep the same smalls, but just move them around a little bit.
Yeah.
But with Eleanor's, the furniture would change, the artwork, more clowns, less clowns. So, yeah.
I've talked about this as well. I really love that chair in Eleanor's house that is sort of a gray mushroom. I think it's a yoga ball with like a neoprene cover.
Yeah.
It looks terrible. It's actually very comfortable.
It's very comfortable.
It is very comfortable. What I don't like is unless the camera is low, you don't see
You don't see it at all. Yeah.
But I really like sitting on it.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
And it also reminds me of like an Apple speaker. For some reason, I feel that you should be able to plug it in or I should connect my Bluetooth to it.
The greatest subwoofer.
Yeah, exactly.
That's a good one.
Full episodes of The Good Place are available on NBC.com and the NBC app. Right now, let's listen to a clip.
Bad Janet, walkie-talkie mode.
Now entering Mindy St. Clair's house.
This is so exciting. I hope everyone gets hurt.
Living room is clear. Entering the bedroom.
Oh, yeah!
Ow.
Oh, God, this feels so weird.
Here we go.
Oh, do some coke off my butt. Wait, whoa. Who are you guys?
Oh, friends. Hi, I'm Derek.
Where are the humans? And who is Derek?
Me is Derek. These are my wind chimes. Oh, my wind chimes like you.
The only people here are Mindy St. Clair and an unknown male with a genital deformity. The four humans are not here.
Where is Michael?
Oh boy.
Hey there, Mike.
Oh, hey, Lance. Looking good, buddy. Lose some weight?
I wish.
Listen up, people. We need to find Michael and we need to be discreet. You, search from the spastic dentistry department down through disembowelment. You, cover children's dance recitals through holiday weekend IKEA. Go.
A scene in which The Good Place, a half-hour comedy show on NBC, becomes an action movie. You certainly have to shoot that differently, right?
Yeah. I mean, it was just, you know, there was a lot of running and everything. Mm-hmm. So, you know, that building that we were shooting in downtown, which I guess is an old bank.
Bank of America.
Yeah, Bank of America, which we found in the first season. Actually, we've all shot there for different reasons over the years. But just lent itself to a lot of different locations in one building. And, you know, when you're making a half-hour show, that's what you're looking for. You're looking to try to get the most variety that you can get without having to move the company, you know, in that place. Afforded us that, you know, pretty well.
There are different looks within it, for sure.
Yeah, absolutely.
What's different about how you light and filter and is the between The Good Place, which is very sort of primary colored, the neighborhood I'm talking about, 12358W, and then going back in time, like, what in your mind, how do you frame those differences aesthetically? It's darker.
Yeah, well, I mean, I didn't want to go to the typical, you know, Bad Place being hell, mm-hmm. which it was, mm-hmm. it is, but, you know, I didn't want to go with the red motif, so I just wanted to go ahead and, you know, make it monochromatic. So I took a lot of the color out. It's definitely tinted more of a blue.
It's almost a blue black vision. And white.
Yeah, it's very black and white. One of the things we had talked about, actually, when this is in the first season with Dan Bishop, was the production designer, and we're starting to talk about it, you know, we were talking about laying out the things, and I was talking about Billy Wilder and how much I liked, I think it's The Apartment with Jack Lemmon, mm-hmm. where he works in this huge office building, you know, with just rows and rows and rows of desks, in which Dan had wanted to do the rows of desks. And then we were talking about, we were putting green screen deep, and we were going to place something behind it. I can't remember what, we were just going to maybe do architecture or something. And I thought it would be great if we could just do more rows of people, mm-hmm. you know, tile the people on. So it looked like the rows of people just went to infinity.
Yeah.
And then it was just really, you know, we got there and I wanted to, you know, I had a kind of an idea of what I wanted to do and change the color. And Mike was like, oh, that's interesting. And Drew was like, oh, I love that. And so that just became, you know, the motif. So basically it was just taking it away from that kind of sunlit, beautiful color
right.
to something just more monochromatic. Everything's just almost one color.
So we've got those two contrasting things. What happens when we go back to Earth in flashbacks and stuff? We see, you know, Eleanor's fairly recent past with her roommates and such. Yeah. What's different about that?
I do shoot that pretty straight.
Interesting. You know,
honestly, I just shot it like I would do something like Parenthood.
Okay.
You know, just kind of really simply, just, you know, good solid photography, but, you know, filled in well. And, you know, I mean, the whole show is filled in.
Tell me what you mean by that.
Well, in other words, if I'm doing something like a drama, something that's really heavy, the light will come from one side and one side of somebody's face will be dark. You know, in this show, you know, people really don't have, at least in The Good Place or on Earth, people's faces are filled in. You can see both eyes, where in The Bad Place,
it is,
you know,
noir.
It's more noirish. Yeah,
yeah, I mean, more key light.
You know, I mean, I really wanted The Bad Place to be like a 1950s noir film.
It is. You've done it. It's so great.
Yeah.
So we go to the Museum of Human Misery, which we shot in the chocolate shop downtown. So what's the first that you get of that? And what does that say to you about like what pieces you want to put in it?
It was a lot of planning for that space because we had talked with the writers and there must have been a list of maybe 30 vignettes that we could have done.
You're referring to the evidences of humans being terrible, things like the first person to floss in an open plan office, right, or the first man to send an unsolicited picture of his genitals.
Right, which I think we ended up with like seven of with people.
Right.
But then all the cabinets and everything were like cheese graters. Like,
oh, you're right.
All of
torture
these,
tools.
Yeah, like a beehive of like bees that would attack you. So we really tried to like get all of these pieces in because you never know where the camera's going.
Right.
I don't usually scout with David, so I don't know what his angles are. When we go in and we scout that space, it's more like, okay, we're gonna make this floor plan and everything, but we don't know where the actors are really gonna land. I mean, the director is there and they talk about it, but it's when the cameras get there, things change.
Of course.
I mean, maybe I dressed a better corner over here and David likes it, you know, or the director sees it and it's better if they come in this way, or maybe the actors feel more comfortable coming in over here, or the writing has changed and now we need this. So my job is basically to do the four walls and not believe that, oh, we're not going to see this.
Right.
And so when everyone walks into the space, they have the illusion that they're there. They're in that museum.
But the point, I think what makes it even more remarkable is that like you can't cheat much, right? Like if there's going to be a curio cabinet full of stuff that might get a lot of focus.
Exactly.
You might see all those cheese graters.
Exactly.
So they have to be authentic looking torture tools.
Yeah.
And do you guys build those or do you?
We rented them and then we came up with the pieces of what that would pertain, all these sort of torture things. And then we had signs made up for like specifically, I think like 25 or 30.
The plaques.
Yeah.
Wait, that many?
There was a lot.
Wow.
There was a lot. All of those cases were filled. Even the ones, it was like fidget spinners. Like that was torture. Like everything.
That remains torture to this day.
Obviously, we had a lot of knives and other pieces that visually you wouldn't know.
Right.
But for the audience, we thought, well, we have these things here in case they were zoomed in on or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
So.
And what's great is, you know, Kim sets it up so I can look four different ways, which is really important because when I get in there, you know, the director might have an opinion, you know, about it in a certain way. I might have an opinion in a certain way, you know, so it's nice to be able to look all the different positions. But also she gives stuff like, I love that wall of skulls thing.
Yes.
Because when I saw that,
oh, yeah,
I was like, okay.
And you lit it.
Yeah, I lit it from underneath. And I said, we're definitely going to stage a bunch of action against this. And at the kind of the end of the scene, you know, there's a conversation that takes place in front of it. So that, you know, keying off when you walk into the space and you see like, oh, well, that's interesting. Let's use that. Or
like opportunities.
Oh, yeah. And also it can become opportunities for the actors too, mm-hmm, because, oh, well, I can pick up this device and
some
use
business.
This. Yeah. You're just always looking for business. And it's the same for me.
Because I don't actually see this that's lit.
Right.
You can see a box. Yeah. That's true.
A lot of times
the truck hasn't arrived yet, right?
Like, I don't. Sometimes I dress in the dark. I mean, it gets with like work lights.
Wow.
So and then you know you see it, and if we have practicals and the lighting, they're great, and they'll put them on. But the enhancements, I don't usually see until you're set up.
So here we are in the Museum of Human Misery with Diana Tremaine, Rhonda Mumps, Jake Jordals. And Chidi can't come up with a name because it pains him so terribly to lie. A different character mistakes him for Trent, that different character played by Dax Shepard, who later has a great moment with his real-life wife, Kristen Bell, where he says something like, you got the good stank or something.
It's like, smash you later.
That's right. they've got good rapport. I'll say it right now.
It's magic. The two of them.
The space, I think we built a stage within this with a curtain that was practical as well to reveal the animatrons of the actors. And then, of course, there's a complicating factor of a fire bar. Manny Jacinto throws
the Molotov cocktail.
There's a Molotov cocktail, and I'm laughing because I'm remembering one take where you were over him looking at me, and he broke me because the business wasn't going well of stuffing the rag into it and pretending to light the Zippo lighter or whatever. And Manny lets out this and it broke me completely. It was a useless take that I think made a gag reel somewhere. I've seen it. But we did have a practical fire effect when he throws it.
Yeah, I mean, whenever possible, if I can use real fire, I'll use it because I just think
a child. Or is that an M80s firecracker?
That was expunged from my record.
Yeah. No proof. Yeah. No proof.
But yeah, because it's just, you know, you can't get that fire effect. You can get it, but it's just so nice to have the real flame mm-hmm. up in front of the shot. You know, and it was a dangerous space that we were working in, but the fire department was terrific with us, you know, in helping us to let us do it. And it just makes all the difference in the world.
What is it? It's like a low bar. It's not small. It was a bar probably six or eight feet long.
It was
long.
A big bar, yeah.
That's got propane hooked up to it, I guess.
Yeah.
And when you call the cue, then somebody opens the valve and it goes...
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
It's super dangerous, but...
It looked great.
It looked great.
Because I watched it again last night. So, you know, it was really... It really works because, you know, there's nothing more effective than real firelight on people's faces. I don't care. You can spend all the time in the world and build all the special effects
with your computers.
Rigs. Yeah, but it's just nothing like burning something up to really make it work.
Later, we find ourselves in a situation room where Sean and his team are launching this operation. It was another opportunity for me to go into walkie-talkie mode, this time with Bad Janet. If you've never had the opportunity to shout into another person's open mouth, try it, because it's hilarious and the weirdest. The first time we did it was in season one, and Darcy and I had just met, and Mike was like, I really need you to get in there, or maybe it was Dean, and I was like, I feel like I'm pretty close. He's like, no, get right up in there. And Darcy's an improviser, and I'm an improviser, and I was like, am I good? And she's like, do your worst. And I got right up in there. And when you can hear your own voice echoing within someone else's skull, it's odd. It's a very strange thing. But yeah, this becomes an action movie at this point, where we turn around, and it's that old device of a spinning chair, like almost cartoon, Wile E. Coyote.
It's very Looney Tunes.
Yeah, it's Looney Tunes. And then it's a running scene. Michael flees with the coats, everybody's jacket, with their senior staff pin, which is, of course, the key to the portal, or Bortles, as Jason later yells. And Michael runs past a giant sort of three-mouthed lamprey character named Lance. No one's reached out to me on the internet about the actor that plays Lance. I wonder if people realize who that is. And then, of course, he gets to the portal, and we have this lovely and amazing scene with high stakes. I mean, backlit me with haze and stuff, and it's, you know, the clock's ticking.
They were very villainous.
I know. My sister texted me, and my sister's about 10 years older than I am, and she texted, and you could feel her being quizzical in the text. She was like, you're a badass, which I don't think to this point people had ever realized. It's a nice muscle to be able to flex. But in the course of all this mayhem and, you know, sending Tahani through, sending Jason through, sending Chidi through, Kristen so lovelily conveys the, like, come on, man, like, now's not the time, we got to go. And then Michael says, I finally solved the trolley problem. It's not about not killing those people. The only option is to sacrifice yourself. And it's a really moving, moment between these two America's sweethearts. When you read something like that in the script, David, like, what does it say to you about lens sizes and angles and like, what does it mean? Do you know how you want to shoot that different than other things?
Yeah, I mean, the truth is I've done it for so long now. Sure. When I read it, I see it in my head.
It's beautiful.
Exactly. So I know exactly how it's going to go together, you know, and you know, talk to the director and see, you know, what his or her thoughts are about, you know, what they're thinking. But, you know, at that point, like, I know what it's going to be. So my thoughts go to mechanically how I'm going to go ahead and put it together. One, artistically, efficiently, you know, how I can go ahead and just kind of make it work in the simplest way. Mm-hmm. You know, a big thing for me is trying to find a way to make it work the most for the actors, because I want to try to set it up. And I think one of the reasons that I've been successful in my career is that I'm always trying to find a way to satisfy myself visually, but also find a way to allow the actor to get the most out of the moment, to not interrupt their process unless I really have to. And I think, you know, and I think I've been rewarded for that because actors do appreciate it.
Is that a matter of keeping the lens out of their field of vision?
No,
what does that mean to you?
No, I mean, because most actors are, you know, are comfortable around the camera, but it's setting it up so that the scene, for me, I set up, I think the one thing in this show, and I've done in a lot of shows, and, you know, and I'm doing Veep now, it's the same thing. It's setting it up so I don't interrupt the flow.
Okay.
Because there's just something about it when you can go ahead and the actors start to do it and they don't have to be interrupted by the mechanics of the camera, that they can just go ahead and allow themselves to go ahead and be in the moment and act where it works the best. And a lot of times, you know, I'm a big proponent of doing two takes at a time, because a lot of times, you know, you'll get through, the actors will get through the first take and there'll be a few bumps. Mm-hmm. But if you don't give any notes and you don't interrupt, just go ahead and just go right back into it, you'll find that 90% of the time, all the questions that you had from the first take will be solved by the actor themselves. You know, that's why I always say to directors, because, you know, again, television is different than a movie. You know, movie, the director's been there for a year and a half or whatever amount of time preparing it. In a television show, the director is pushed in 3 or 4 days before the show starts. Mm-hmm. And one thing I kind of always say with this cast, but most casts, it's like after the first take, don't give a bunch of notes. Just let them go ahead and do it again the second time, because in the reality of the situation is they have already heard all the mistakes that they've made in
their
head.
Probably more aware of it.
Yeah, and they're already punishing themselves for what they've done. So they don't need to be their punishment reinforced. It's just like, say, go again.
Right.
And then, as I said before, 90% of the questions, the problems will go away. And then you're just left having to give one or two little notes because, you know, at this point, especially on a show, you know, it's the third season, people know what their characters are. Mm-hmm. You know, they know who they are. You know, they just need to be reminded sometimes about as to where they are in the script, where in the story. Do they know a piece of information? You know, do they not know that piece of information? Mm-hmm. And then it's just the classic, you know, faster, slower.
And I think that I've witnessed the same thing happen behind the camera. Your dudes that are the operators are really good at communicating with one another. I see Josh and Johnny and Trey, just as you're saying, like they might have gotten with, you know, a matte box or a brow or whatever within somebody else's shot. They communicate it with no ego involved, and the next time around, they are able to go like, "Does this work for you?" And they're so, it's yet one more example of sort of the no jerks rule of a Mike Schur set,
right?
And everybody, like, nobody's like, "Oh man, you boned my shot," you know, "you dollied right into my shot." They're like, "Hey, could I, like, what's your final position? Because I'll adjust." Like, it's a really great sort of zenny mind path.
What's funny, because I'll get up, because I'll see something and I'll kind of stick my head in and then I'll just see them look up and they're like, "You got it, right?" And they're like, "Yeah, we fixed it." Yeah. Okay, good. I'll go sit down now.
It's kind of amazing. It's kind of great.
Promotional consideration is furnished by the following totally real advertiser.
International Sophisticate Magazine. Need to redesign the backgammon salon in your winter getaway castle's guard quarters? Pick up the latest issue of International Sophisticate Magazine, the only periodical that is not for sale. If you have to ask where to buy it, you're not allowed to read it. International Sophisticate Magazine. We give this podcast zero Gwyneths. Podcasts are quite banal.
Kim, we talked, we did an episode of this podcast earlier today talking about, it was the existential crisis, which was Tahani was throwing a party that she knew was going to be a lesser party. I think it was in a hotel downtown. Maybe there was sort of a almost Gone with the Wind staircase. Like
the Biltmore.
That's a pretty big space to have to dress, right?
I mean, it's a gorgeous room anyway, but you can't help but spice it up with some balloons. I mean, balloons go a long way. They got great production value.
It's also become sort of a theme within the show. Like,
balloons.
Yeah. Balloons seem to make their way into the show quite a bit. What have been some of the bigger challenges for you throughout the two seasons that we've seen so far of sets to dress?
I think that when you are on a show like this and the boundaries aren't there that you usually have because we're in The Good Place or we're in The Bad Place.
It's kind of infinite, right?
Yeah, you have to, there are boundaries you set up for yourself, or the designer sets up, or they've established, like one of the rules that they had really was like, there's no red.
They didn't want to tip that it was hell at all.
Right.
Costume sets.
Right. So I think there's a balance there where you still have to remember we're tricking them that they're in the good place, but it's really the bad place. Or your limit of like throwing the grandest party, but it can't be as nice as the other party.
As
like
Gunner's party. Yeah.
Yeah. So there are those restrictions there, but it's a great challenge decorating wise. And it's fun. I mean, I loved the second season was fantastic because those boundaries really aren't there, but they are. It's not like on the Earth scenes where it's more reality.
Right. For a show like this, I guess for any show that you've worked on, do you have a Hall of Fame of set decoration? Are you like, I am proudest of this scene?
I am very proud of a set I did on Bones.
Oh.
Because I got a ton of paper from the LA Times, like 7 pallets of used newspapers.
Newsprint, yeah.
And we did a hoarder's apartment.
Oh, man.
And it was kind of the first time and maybe the only time where the set decoration completely trumped everyone else, the camera department, everyone, because we couldn't move anything. Like the actors could barely move inside the space.
You built like tunnels of stacks of papers.
And kind of like, the Collyard Brothers. There's these Collyard Brothers in the 1940s,
that was real,
I think.
Yeah.
They were these rich millionaires in New York, and they were hoarders and buried themselves in their mansion on like Fifth Avenue. And so I really took a lot from that. But it was just a set of being able to express a character through every single piece of paper or guitars or lunchboxes or in that room and show the sickness of it.
Yeah.
But the fascination of like, wow, people live like this. And and I think lighting and everything, it was, we all collaborated on it, but it was like, you can't move anything. Because that's one of the things, when I leave set, and David,
everything gets moved.
Everything gets moved, and I have to leave because it hurts my feelings.
It's forking.
This is all wrong.
Like, all right, they're moving things. I got to move. I got to leave. I want it just to be as pretty as I left it.
Okay, Jordan, come here. We're going to move everything now.
Yeah. Yes. That and like White House sets on Veep are very, I like to try to historically try to get it as close as possible.
We find ourselves in the Museum of Human Misery, and Janet discovers that there's about to be an exhibit unveiled. She peeks through and sees what it is and says, oh, farts. And it turns out that it is our 4 humans in their own exhibit, and they've made animatrons of them, which I remember on the day they were sort of wearing green screen collars and cuffs where like sort of steampunky gears and windy things were. But talk about how you shot that, because we sort of are looking over the cast, at the cast. How do you do that?
Well, you know, it's David Neenoggle. You know, and David, you know, and I will have a discussion just kind of mechanically how it needs to lay out. You know, he'll give me the requirements of, you know, what he needs to work for him. You know, and then, you know, Alan Yang and I would talk about, you know, the best way to lay it out dramatically. And so it's really just, you know, getting across their backs, you know, having people, we have body doubles to go across the back.
These are people other than the cast who are similar height to the cast?
You know, and they'll be wigged up, they'll be costumed in the same manner. Mm-hmm. And I think I remember that we went ahead and did, I'm not quite sure, I think I might have done the green screen part of it, the green part of it first, because I think we went to lunch or something and they went ahead and put the green on everybody.
Yeah.
We got them up on stage and we shoot all the pieces of that, of them, you know, up there. And then, you know, took all the green around, turn around and put them back in their correct wardrobe, mm-hmm. and then shoot the other side of it, which is, you know, with them playing their real selves again and then with you running in.
Right, when the good parts
exactly.
starts.
That's
when, yeah. That's when the ratings jump. That's when things get good.
Yeah.
I love that Jason asks if there's a gift shop, and Michael says...
Oh, that's a great line.
Jason says, hell, of course there's a gift shop.
One of the best lines ever.
Oh, my goodness. I mean, and Ted is just a sniper with lines like that. There's no other way to deliver a line like that than how he does it. Kim, you mentioned that you printed a lot of plaques for things that we might see in all 4 directions within this place. Do you remember any of them?
A couple of them I know were a hive full of bees with teeth, which our prop master, Gabe Perillo, got a huge a bee's nest that we put in one of the cabinets. Another one was an eyeball corkscrew.
Oh yeah, mentioned
eyeball. Basically, that, yes. Was this like a wine opener, mm-hmm. I used for that. A canker score grater, which was just a grater, like a cheese, big old rusted cheese grater we used. We had a penis flattener, which was a George Foreman grill. I thought, what else can we, if we found a George Foreman grill, and we'll just use that as the penis flattener.
I don't know what I was picturing when until this moment, yeah. But of course it's a Foreman grill.
Yeah. What else is George doing with it? I mean,
it's corrugated and it's heated, which right. I hadn't thought about. I think I was just thinking about weight. That's your thing's worse.
Yeah. It's hell. I had to go above and beyond.
Yeah.
And then there was butt glue, which was just a dollar store hot glue gun that with just like tons of hot glue around it.
Melted around it.
Yeah. Those were a couple that we put in there. So yeah.
I love that, you know, we get the first waiter to approach a diner with an empty plate and sarcastically say, "I guess you hated it." Or the first white person to grow dreadlocks and first person to call Ultimate Frisbee Ultimate, which I think are the same person. Yeah. As it's told in the show.
Yes.
So crazy. So we get to the portal. The clock's ticking. Sean is chasing them. You lit me very nicely. I looked very heroic.
You're very easy to light. You have great skin.
A badass, as my sister put it. And we get down and it's this, you know, really frenetic scene and he's giving pins out and they're jumping through. Jason yells, "Portals!" at this point. And Kristen and Ted have this lovely moment that's unique. It's special.
Well, I think what people don't realize or what really isn't talked about in the show that I think Mike Schur has written one of the great modern romances. It's, you know, Ted's romance for the human race, mm-hmm. but I think especially his romance, which is a chaste romance.
It's a platonic romance. Yeah, it's a non-sexual romance.
You know, for Eleanor.
Yeah.
And there's something incredibly beautiful about it. And in that scene, I think that's the scene that you really, really see it in. Mm-hmm. You know, his just absolute, absolute love for her and her love for him at that moment, you know, and her despair as she's being pushed through the portal.
Right.
And his willingness to do the right thing for her and then to turn around to you and become his sarcastic self. But, you know, as he pushes her through to have that one moment, realizing that he may never see her again, and then turning to you and like going, "Okay, hey, what's up, boss?
Hey, boss, man, what's
up?" You know,
yeah.
And I just think there's something about those two actors. Listen, they're both brilliant actors. And again, I'll just say it, you know, Mike has written a great modern romance.
I'm going to some questions from the internet. We source some things from Twitter often. Were there particular shows or movies that you had in mind when you were, you know, working on the looks for the, you know, the real bad place, the fake bad place that is the good place? Like, as you're building some of these, are there benchmark moments for that?
Not exactly. I mean, I think it's everything that I've seen over the years. I think I mentioned before that I was very interested in British films. And one of my favorite directors was Michael Powell, who I was lucky enough to meet before he died. But he's, you know, a fantastic director. And, you know, he made A Matter of Life and Death, The Red Shoes and things like that, Tales of Hoffman. So I really love movies like that. And when we were doing the pilot was done, it was keying off of a lot of what Dan Bishop, the production designer, had done.
Okay.
You know, going like, you know, looking at his drawings and his designs and seeing where he was going. It's like, oh, well, you're taking it that direction. Well, then I can go ahead and continue on and do this. And so, you know, it definitely grew out of conversation and, you know, the artwork that was coming and also just the structure of being on the back lot.
Oh, very
you
cool.
know, looking at it and saying, okay, well, the backlot, you know, we're on Spartacus Square. It was built this way. So this is the best way for me to utilize it. You know, and that goes into, you know, an artistic discussion, but also just physically, where's the sun going to be at what time of day?
Sure.
You know, do we want to look that way? Because, you know, that's the way the trams go by, you know, stuff like that.
The actual tourist trams that are taking tours of the thing.
Yeah.
David, lots of questions about specific filters. Are there those are pieces of glass that have different tints that go in front of the lens?
Yeah, it's pretty much basic. It's just like a half, you know, Hollywood black magic.
I've heard of that before, actually. Yeah.
I thought that was your nickname, actually.
David.
And really, it's, you know, the filtration's pretty basic. It's really the photography that sets it up. It's the lighting. It's the way it's laid out. Okay. You know, it's so funny because people are supposed to specific about, oh, I've got to use this lens or I've got to use primes. It's like, you know, I basically use zooms on all the show because I don't like to, going back to what I was saying earlier, if you've ever been on a set, you'll say we'll do a scene, you know, we'll do a couple shots, and then it'll be time to resize or reframe, and the actors will step off, the stand-ins will come in, and then you'll lay it out all, you know, again with the stand-ins in a different size lens. Well, I hate that. That drives me crazy.
Okay.
And you know, it happened today on Veep. You know, the assistant director called for second team. It's like, no, everybody just squeeze in on the lenses.
You're not swinging lenses, right?
No, often
you're
not swinging lenses.
By which I mean you're not changing lenses to a different millimeter.
No, I mean, I really don't. I mean, the zooms today are so great. And as I tell people, you know, John Seale won, you know, an Academy Award for the English Patient shot basically on one zoom lens with the zoom control taped to the, you know, handles. So, you know, if he can win an Academy Award, you know, I can go ahead and make the good place with what we've got.
In this episode, Eleanor reveals that she's read ahead. She refers to Jonathan Dancy and moral particularism, and that sometimes lying is something that's acceptable in certain situations. Has working on this show made you think differently about how you go through life, about ethical, moral choices that you're faced with and how you make them?
There was a pretty interesting book on death, which is written by the person Mike got in.
The book is called Death.
Did you read it?
It's Todd May. The book is Todd May.
And I've been reading that, and I find that book absolutely fascinating.
Really?
And, you know, it made me definitely appreciate what I have.
Sure.
At least for a moment.
What about you, Kim?
Getting back to work with the group of people from Parks.
Yeah.
And that 4 years for me is almost like high school in my career. It was like the best of times.
Yeah.
It was so hard when I think back of it, these like huge sets. But they were crazy and fun. And all the producers were nice. The cast was nice.
Did you build Tommy's Closet?
Yes.
Yeah?
Yes.
Nice.
We did. Yeah. Rent-a-swag. Yes.
Yeah.
So, it's when I came back into the Mike Schur world, it's just like, you know, it was just sort of like coming home. And that to me takes you back to following projects that you want to work on with passion and good people.
Yeah.
It really was just really nice, like a homecoming feeling.
That's wonderful. Kim Wanup, what's good?
What's good right now is I just started my own podcast.
A podcast?
I did.
A podcast.
A podcast, you say. It's called Decorating Pages. And I get questions emailed to me all the time, like, where did you find that rug or that blanket from, you know, 10 years ago on Bones? And I'm like, hey, man, you're not finding that. It's not a Bed Bath anymore.
Right.
But I started to talk to production designers and art directors and other decorators. And it's just a behind the scenes look of our world that people are interested in.
That's very cool. When I solicited questions for your appearance today on the internet, lots of people had really cool questions, always followed by comma, and will you hire me?
Yeah. Right. Yes, I do get, and that's how they should do it.
Sure.
That's how I did it.
It's your hustle, right?
That's the hustle. So yes, and I always respond. I always respond. So yeah.
David Miller, what's good?
Mark, you know me. I don't think anything's good.
Oh, that's true.
That's true.
You are,
you know,
dark.
I am pretty dark. I'm happy for this show, actually.
Yeah.
Because it's different, you know, and it's not boring.
Yeah.
You know, and the truth is, the job can be very repetitive. And this has always had some kind of twist coming up. And this episode especially was so different than everything else that we had done before.
In scale and movement.
You know, and it was technically really difficult. So, you know, I appreciate that, you know, because I don't, as you know, you get to a certain point where, you know, it's the challenge, you become good at doing it. So when I have an episode or something that's difficult that I really have to think about and work out and make work, I really appreciate that, because that, you know, keeps my interest going, and that's important.
I am so excited for the viewers to see season 3 and how bananas it is.
Yes. I know.
Thank you so much for being with us.
Oh, thank you.
Thank you.
This has been The Good Place, the podcast. I'm Mark Evan Jackson. Go do something good.
This has been The Good Place, the podcast. And now to deliver our credit sequence is Bad Janet. Take it away, Bad Janet.
Whatever. If you enjoyed this podcast, which, like, how is that even possible? Please subscribe. It's available on all major podcasting platforms or wherever you get your podcasts. I don't even know. Or if you don't want to subscribe, you can also just listen to your mom's butt, you fat dink. You burnt.
Why don't I handle the credits? The podcast is hosted by Mark Evan Jackson.
Ew.
Produced by Grant Rutter.
Who?
It's written by Lizzie Pace. Okay. And the music is composed by David Schwartz.
David Schwartz. See you next time, nerds.